The Guardian. Science Weekly from guardian.co.uk.
The whole energy problem is a bond rearrangement problem. And once you start talking bonds, you're talking the currency of chemists.
Hello, this is Science Weekly for June the 16th. I'm Alok Jha. Coming up, we discuss solar power, carbon capture and light conversion with Dan Nocera, the MIT professor who believes chemistry can solve the energy crisis. Also in the podcast,
we have to understand that it's both our abilities and luck that matter, and that the luck part is often underestimated.
Theoretical physicist Leonard Mlodinow explains how randomness rules our lives. Plus, stink bombs, the Methuselah tree, and why it's now safe to go back in the water. This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. So we're back in the studio, and you know what? I've got a good feeling about all this. Ian Sample is a Guardian science correspondent. Ian, are you sharing my optimism?
Yeah, definitely.
Excellent. Fair enough. Back after a month away, Nell Bowes. Been sailing anywhere, Nell?
Sadly not. I've been at the Hay Books Festival.
And did you enjoy it?
It was good.
Ian had all sorts of nasty things to say about it, actually. I won't make him repeat it, but, you know.
They were good moments.
He did go running back.
Interesting people.
He did go running back for the second weekend, I'll point out. By the way, did you like The Boss this weekend?
He rocked.
I wouldn't have put you down for a Springsteen fan.
Just a closet fan.
Incredible. Well, let's get things going. Climate change and solving the energy crisis, two of the most crucial problems facing the modern world, especially if you read The Guardian. They're topics we come back to time and time again here on the pod. We'll talk about carbon capture in just a minute because, believe me, it's something that's been very, very dear to my heart over the past week. First, though, let's hear from Dan Nocera. He's Professor of Chemistry and Energy at MIT and one of the world's leading and most creative thinkers when it comes to solving the energy crisis. Naturally enough, though, he thinks that chemistry holds the key to this. He told me why.
In a general sense, why chemistry? And I really firmly believe that's the science that will solve this energy problem. And it's really easy to understand. When you burn a fuel, you take gasoline, you burn it with oxygen, you make CO2 in water, and then you get energy out. Well, when you're burning that fuel, what you're doing is you're taking the carbon and carbon-hydrogen bonds, that's what composes a fuel, and then you rearrange those bonds with oxygen to make CO2 and water. And there's the answer. I said you rearrange bonds. So physicists deal with things inside the nucleus of an atom. Chemists deal with things outside the nucleus, the stuff that sticks them together, bonds. And so the whole energy problem is a bond rearrangement problem. And once you start talking bonds, you're talking the currency of chemists. So that's why chemistry will solve this problem, and it's got to be the central science of this problem. It's intrinsic. Now, that's for the fuel part. There's also capturing solar light and converting it finally into fuels. That is a broader problem. It involves physics. This is the photovoltaic part of the problem. But again, centrally, it involves chemistry because we have photovoltaics at work. They're too expensive. The way you're going to get that into the market is discovering new materials. And chemists are sort of the cooks of science. We make new materials.
The photovoltaics being the sort of usual solar panels that people are used to which generates electricity. But can you tell me what kinds of projects you're working on in your department?
When we think about the energy problem, and it's a little bit complex, but I'm going to break it down so it's really easy. There's three components. The type of renewable energy I'm interested in is using sunlight and storing that energy for us to use. And so that renewable energy, I'm solar power. Now, when you start thinking about solar energy, you feel it every day. That just goes into heat. So what you need to do, here are the three components of solar energy. You got to capture the sunlight, and then you got to convert it from light energy to another form of energy. The easiest form of energy is to convert it into an electrical current, but this is a little different electrical current. This electrical current isn't the type you're used to plugging into the wall because that electrical current runs through wires. Same type of current, but it's wireless. So here's the first two parts of the solar problem, capture and conversion. Capture the light, convert it into wireless current. That's what a photovoltaic does. But at the end of the day, for the problems I'm worried about globally, you need to store that energy. So you got to store that energy in some form. There's basically only two ways to store that energy. One is in chemical bonds. Now we're back to that chemistry thing. That's what I'm interested in. In fuels. That's what a fuel is. So we'll take that electrical current and then store it in a bond rearrangement to make a high-energy fuel that we could use some later time. Or the other thing is in a battery. We could just keep that electrical current stored in a battery, and then at night you could use the battery. So those are the two areas that people are looking at right now. I'm in the fuel storage, and that is a code word for photosynthesis, artificial photosynthesis. So when you hear the word artificial photosynthesis, it's exactly what a plant does. The leaf absorbs energy. It actually sets up a wireless current, leaves a buzzing with electricity. Nobody realizes it. And then it takes that wireless current and it stores it in fuels. And you know those fuels. Oxygen is one. And then it actually makes hydrogen initially, a solid form of hydrogen. And then it takes that hydrogen and combines it with CO2 and stores it in sugars and starches, what you eat. So that's what artificial photosynthesis is, capture, conversion, and then storage in fuels.
I'm assuming that your artificial photosynthesis doesn't produce glucose and sugar and things like that. So what are you producing at the end of it?
We could do that. So now you're getting to a touchy subject in the renewable energy game, and that is when you do photosynthesis, the first thing that photosynthesis does is it stores energy in oxygen and hydrogen, a solid form of hydrogen, though, not gaseous hydrogen. When I do my business, what I'm going to do is I would like to make a catalyst. This is the thing that will take the wireless current and then act on the water and also make hydrogen and oxygen. But my hydrogen's gaseous because when you split water, you have to get gaseous hydrogen and oxygen. And so the next question is, do you want to use that hydrogen directly? You hear that argument all the time. It's a gas. Or maybe I would want to kind of do what photosynthesis does and take the hydrogen and combine it with CO2 and make a fuel, a liquid fuel, not a sugar or starch. I don't have to go that whole distance, but I can go partway. Partway would be an alcohol. So when I do my business, I split water to hydrogen and oxygen. That's good enough fuel, and you can use fuel cells. That's what fuel cells do. It combines the hydrogen and oxygen and extracts the energy out again. I could use that as a fuel, but because of the problems of a gaseous fuel source, you might want to take that hydrogen and make a liquid fuel out of it. But the important point is there's no escaping hydrogen, because if you're going to use water plus sunlight as your fuel source to rearrange the water bonds to make hydrogen and oxygen, I have to deal with hydrogen up front. I might need to do something with it. I might not want to use it as a primary fuel. But in my business, there's no avoiding it.
Science Weekly from Guardian.co.uk with Alok Jha.
Dan Nocera there. We'll hear more of that interview later in the show. Now then, hands up in the pod who wants to ask me about carbon capture.
It's an audio show.
You can pretend.
Okay, I want to ask you about carbon capture.
Carbon capture and storage. For anyone who hasn't read the Guardian website this last week, I did a huge story about carbon capture and storage. Stop yawning, Ian. He was actually yawning. Carbon capture and storage, which is a technology that can strip the carbon dioxide from power stations and store it underground, deep underground in aquifers, to prevent the carbon dioxide contribution to climate change. A brilliant technology, you might say. Why isn't it happening right now? Well, this is exactly what my investigative piece was all about. And I can come down to descriptions of why it's not happening and why, you know, how we can solve the climate change thing really quite quickly if we invested in this. You two sound look really interested.
Yeah, I'd like to
ask
hear
me a
more.
Question.
I'd like to hear more.
What would you like to know specifically?
It seems an implausible way to scrub to capture the carbon dioxide and go and store it somewhere. Seems sort of like scrubbing up after the event. How easy is it?
Well, all of the various elements of carbon capture. This is the trapping certain gases from power stations, transporting it and then burying it into geological formations or old oil fields. All these things are done all the time by oil people anyway, or chemical engineering plants. It's just that no one's put them all together and strapped it onto a power station. So What you want is in the next decade, 7 or 10 demonstration plants, because it's going to be very expensive. It's an engineering project, so things will go wrong. It's not easy, because there are slight questions that are unanswered. So it'll cost billions of pounds to do this, but it's possible. It's perfectly doable. Ask any engineer, and they all say, we can do this. It's just going to cost a lot of money. There are some estimates they have that if we don't do anything about any of this, using carbon capture, the fact that we're going to be using many, many more coal-fired power stations and fossil fuels will still be a massive part of our energy mix for a long, long time, because coal is so cheap and there's hundreds of years of it left. The fact is that it'll cost 40 billion euro extra if we don't use CCS, carbon capture and storage, in the next couple of decades. Ian, you seem to be very interested now.
Yeah, no, I mean, is it right that obviously we have power stations all over the country, and you know, we're only talking about Britain here for now, and that these would have to, they would capture the carbon, but then presumably nearby it would be pressurized, which would obviously take a lot of energy, and then transported, which would take a lot of energy, presumably to some centralized depository or something like that. And then you're talking about putting them into aquifers. I mean, do you mean empty, you know, aquifers that are now empty of water? This is just porous rock underground?
No, I think they dissolve them into the porous rock with the water. The question about transport is a good one, actually. And the infrastructure is extremely expensive. They reckon that it'll cost something like £1 million per mile for pipes to transport liquefied carbon dioxide. And then something like £1 billion per power station to retrofit them to actually capture the carbon and stuff. Really, this is not a technology for old power stations, because the energy penalty is enormous. You would soak up something like 40% of the energy a power station produces. So that's not too much of a problem now. It's all about the new power stations. China is building a power station a week that's going to be coal-fired. And the idea is that this should really have carbon capture, so that you can use this energy, you can allow their economic and social development. I mean, no one's going to deny them that. But to do it in a way that doesn't contribute to climate change. The stuff about how you transport it and the infrastructure, these are good questions. This is why it's uneconomical to do at the moment. This is why it's not going as fast as it should, which is that no one wants to pay for this. There's no one that wants to pay for it, because you're essentially asking power companies to make electricity for more money, and they can't sell it for more money, because in the open market it won't compete.
But how does retrofitting a new power station compare to building a power station, for example, supported with the photovoltaic cells or the solar power that Nocera was talking about?
Well, photovoltaics are very, very expensive. You wouldn't build
new technology that he was talking about.
Well, the photovoltaics, as far as I can gather, still need some big scientific discovery to make them viable economically, really. You can use them to heat up your water in tanks or something, or you can use them to power your home in bits, but they're just too expensive, and you need some new material, like Nocera was saying, before they're going to become viable. There's the renewable energy in the form of wind power or tidal barrages and stuff. Again, they're all coming, but there's no way anyone's projecting that they'll be enough to feed the energy requirement we have. The International Energy Authority reckons that by 2030, the global energy use will be 50% up, and most of that's going to be China and India and so on. And compared to coal, compared to fossil fuels that we have, none of these other technologies are going to be cheap enough. Coal is dirt cheap, literally, which is why China is going to use it. And, you know, if they're going to use it, then the best way to use it is to have this carbon capture technology, which can take 90% or so of the carbon emissions away. Anyway, we'll stop that there. There's more questions than I would have expected, boys and girls. Thanks for that. It's makes my heart leap with joy. You can read much more about all of that carbon capture stuff, though, at guardian.co.uk/environment. And there's even a blog and some interactive graphics and everything. It's a bonanza over there. I'm Alok Jha. You're listening to Science Weekly from The Guardian. Still to come, we talk science, statistics and probability with theoretical physicist Leonard Mlodinow. But first, here are some of the other stories making science headlines over the past 7 days. Here's Ian and Nell with the News Jam.
News Jam.
A space telescope built to observe the most violent events in the universe has been launched from Cape Canaveral Air Force Station in Florida. NASA's GLAST mission will scour the universe for gamma rays, which are released by supermassive black holes, merging neutron stars, and streams of hot gas that hurtle through space at tremendous speeds. The $700 million space observatory will take pictures of the gamma ray universe, shedding light on mysteries such as the source of gamma rays and how black holes can accelerate immense jets of material to nearly the speed of light.
An ancient seed that germinated after being recovered from the rubble of King Herod's pleasure palace has been dated as 2,000 years old, smashing the record for the oldest seed ever grown. The plant now stands 1.5 metres tall, and it's been named Methuselah Tree after the oldest character in the Bible.
The gas that provides millions of schoolchildren with hours of fun and gives stink bombs their revolting smell could soon provide doctors with new treatments for conditions ranging from strokes to chronic arthritis. Hydrogen sulfide, the source of rotten eggs' unpleasant odour, could be used to put patients with strokes or serious injuries into a form of suspended animation to help them survive severe traumas. The research is being backed by the US military, who believe it could help their surgeons cope with injuries suffered by soldiers in battle.
And finally, just when you thought it was safe to go back in the water, again, it probably is. Canadian researchers have found that sharks in the Mediterranean Sea have suffered dramatic declines in the past few decades as overfishing has taken its toll. The blue shark and mackerel shark have experienced population falls of at least 96%, while the researchers believe the hammerhead population has fallen 99.99% in 200 years.
Thank you both. In homage to our Tech Weekly podcast, let's get the skinny on some of those stories. Listen, enormous space telescopes. Ian, you're space mad at the moment. There's been lots going on. But tell us quickly about this telescope.
Well, GLAST is a space observatory that's going to be orbiting Earth and looking out to map the universe in the what's known as the gamma ray spectrum. So you can look out to space and look at the sort of spectrum of light that comes from X-rays and such, like obviously visible light, which we can see. This will look at the most energetic stuff that's out there in the universe, which is gamma rays.
I was going to say it's been a busy month for NASA. What else has been going on? What's up there at the moment?
Well, NASA have been spending a lot of time focusing on Phoenix, which is their Mars lander, which landed while we were away, actually. Since it landed, one of its main sort of mission objectives is to use this 2-metre-odd long arm it's got to kind of scoop around on the Martian surface and try and get hold of some frozen soil and check what's in it by heating up on one of its little onboard ovens. And they've had a few problems with that. The mud is so kind of cloddy, as they call it, so stuck together that when they try and put it onto the lander, the particles of soil haven't been falling through to the sensor, essentially. So, but we've had some good news at the end of last week, actually, where they finally said that some of the mud has got through into this oven. They can start cooking it up and looking at what they've actually found there. What you know, whether there is any water ice or what have you among that soil. And that's taken quite a long time. I mean, it's been a good few days for them to do that. And they've been pretty ingenious in how they've done it, which is always good to watch. They've sort of ended up scooping up the soil and tilting it, and then just using this little motor on the back of the scooper to vibrate it. So it's basically like shaking salt out over your dinner.
We'll move on now to the Methuselah tree. Now, the first line of the story made me laugh. An ancient seed that germinated after being recovered from the rubble of King Herod's pleasure palace. I'm not sure I believe any of that, but Ian, convince me.
King absolutely.
Herod's pleasure palace, first of all.
This is it's an amazing place, actually. I mean, it was built on a rocky outcrop on the eastern edge of the Judean desert overlooking the Dead Sea. And it was it's known as Masada. It's a fairly well-known fortress where there was a mass suicide when the Romans were attacking some sort of Jewish zealots who had holed up in the place. But anyway, Herod turned it into one of his sort of pleasure palaces, had a wonderful time there. Now, in the 1960s, it was excavated, and the archaeologists went in, and they found these seeds under some rubble leading to one of the entrances to one of these rooms. And so it wasn't buried in the soil, but the incredibly dry and hot conditions seemed to preserve these seeds to some point. And although this seed was buried 2005, 3 years ago now, they didn't want to pick any bits off the seed to date it. They dated a couple of others they found, but this one they hadn't actually confirmed the date of until this study, where they managed to find some shells of the root on the roots, sent those off for carbon dating in Zurich, and it turns out to be about 2,000 years old.
What's the seed of?
It's a date palm. I'm sorry, it's a date palm, which was apparently there's this as you will well know that this ancient historian Josephus, who documented the some of the original wars in the region. And he would talk about there being miles and miles of date palms, forests running from the Sea of Galilee to the Dead Sea, just a huge thing. It was their major export. It was on the coins. It defined the region in some respects. And now, you know, this date palm is ancient. You don't find it anymore. I mean, there are more modern types, but they're mostly imported from Morocco and Egypt and such like. And they're genetically very different.
So have they done any genetic analyses on them?
They have. They looked at 399 markers of some of the more modern dates that they grow now. And they found that this particular date palm differs in 50% of those. So it's a pretty different kind of pretty different species. But the kind of the message, I suppose, is that it's worth holding on to these things. It's worth for museums not throwing out these old seeds of these probably extinct plants, and to think about them as conservation.
Well, it must have come as a good sort of thing for the Millennium Bank Seed Project. Kew Gardens have been running this for nearly a decade now, where they've gone around the world collecting rare seeds, and they want to sort of freeze them in case they go extinct and they can regrow them. I remember speaking to one of the scientists there many years ago now, and he was saying that they put them in a fridge, but they have no idea really if they're going to survive for several hundred years. This is great that they do.
Did they have to use any particular germination techniques? Have they got stuff that we can learn from in that way?
Yeah. And it's interesting. I mean, the woman who did this, who was fascinating actually, she said she got the idea for this when she was reading about how an incendiary bomb fell on the Natural History Museum in London, and the fire brigade turned up and used an awful amount of water to put the damn thing out. And they noticed at the end of it that some of the seeds in their collection, which were up to 400 years old, had begun to germinate.
No way!
And she thought, well, even some of these seeds. So she then started casting around. Instead of just looking around for rare species that were still in existence, she started going to museum collections and trying to find those. But there was a woman on this study who is one of the world experts in sort of germinating these really fragile and sort of delicate seeds. And she used a sort of series of sort of pretty much hormone-laced fertilizers to kind of coax it back. And then, you know, back into a little pot and got the thing going. Yeah,
this
it was quite
ultimate
a
extreme
feat.
Gardening, this, isn't it?
It is.
Brilliant.
This is such a British story.
I want to do this.
Only Brits would do this, this whole gardening thing.
They're Israeli.
All right, fine. Let's not do that. Let's cut that bit out.
That stays. That brilliant.
Especially the pause afterwards.
quickly, sharks. Ian, they're your favourite animal or your nightmare. Well, I don't know, which one is it?
I'm.
They're both, aren't they, basically? They're basically
going. Ambivalent about
sharks. They're going anyway, aren't they? 99.99% of hammerheads have disappeared.
I'm happy for them to exist, but I just don't really want to be there while they're existing. Yeah.
I'm sure they don't want to be anywhere near you either.
But why are they going? Is it just overfishing or is it climate?
It's not only overfishing, but that is, I mean, this was a study in the Mediterranean, and there the problem is almost completely overfishing. I mean, they are caught for their fins for soups. There are no actual quotas in Europe and saying how many setting limits on how many you can take. They've just been fished down. And because sharks reach maturity so slowly and they have so few young, they're really vulnerable to overfishing. So in the past, they were kind of a nuisance for fisheries and no one really bothered about them. They would be caught by accident a lot of the time, and people would either just chuck them back and they'd be damaged and die. Now people are going after them intentionally and have been doing so for several decades. And it's really, really hit their populations big style. Well, what was interesting about this study, let's first say these studies keep appearing in the newspaper because they're done in different oceans and different bodies of water. And this one in the Mediterranean, they wanted to look at the top 20 of sharks that you can find in the Mediterranean. But they could only look at five because they only had enough kind of statistical weight for five of them to even look at the numbers. The rest, a lot of them, the numbers were so small they couldn't even make any statistical sense of them. So they're probably already way below, you know, those numbers have already crashed so low that you're not even catching them, to count the numbers.
All right, well, we'll leave that there. To have your say on any of this stuff, head to blogs.guardian.co.uk/science or post something on the Facebook wall. Now, we're all trying to make some sense out of chaos here in the pod. Well, that's the plan anyway. Someone of a similar but far more intelligent mindset is Leonard Mlodinow. He's a theoretical physicist at the California Institute of Technology, a Hollywood scriptwriter, and also the co-author of A Briefer History of Time. His latest book is called The Drunkard's Walk, and in it he explains how randomness, chance, and probability can explain a tremendous amount about our daily lives.
First of all, I want to say that I'm not saying that hard work and ability, talent are meaningless. What I am saying is that you have to superimpose on that the random factors and random events that occur. And it's those, it's your hard work, your underlying abilities, plus all that randomness and your reaction to the randomness that determines your path in life. If you look at the drunkard's walk, which is just simply a term for another word for what mathematicians also call a random walk or just random meanderings, it will still get from point A to point B, even if it doesn't have a direction. And one might assume, looking back at that, that it aimed for point B from point A, but it's going to get to some point anyway, and it's not proper to assume that when it got somewhere that it was headed there. Now, in life, you are headed somewhere, but You're tossed in one way or another by different things that happen to you. And I'm sure we can all look back at our lives, at our businesses, and find things that even were seemingly seemed to be small at the time that had a big influence on us. So we have to understand that it's both our abilities and luck that matter, and that the luck part is often underestimated. What that means is, for instance, if we have failures, we shouldn't take them to heart. We should keep trying. The most important thing is to keep trying and to be persistent. Psychologists have found that the most important quality in success or for successful people is persistence. So what you learn is that don't take rejection to heart, keep trying. If you do have great success, you learn don't get a big head and think that you're better than other people. And you learn a lot of very positive lessons that allow you to deal with life in a better way and also to make better decisions in life, better financial decisions and better judgments.
But also, I suppose you've got to realize that you can't be completely predictable. You can't predict the future perfectly, so you mustn't ever have total faith in exactly what your predictions and decisions are.
That's right. And in each realm, I think the role of luck has a greater or a lesser effect. You have to really look at what you're talking about. But in general, it has an effect that we underestimate, and you should appreciate it.
Now, some of the things in your book are about what makes something popular, and as you mentioned, films and books sometimes are rejected by people, and we look back in hindsight and say, my God, that was such a silly decision. Of course, the Beatles should have been signed up by Decca Records or something like that, for example. But what about your book? Have you employed any clever mathematical tactics to make it more popular?
Well, I've employed these rules throughout my career, actually, just in terms of following what I believed in, what I was passionate about, and not trying to overplan things and think that I could maximize my chance of success by being very clever about it. And I realized that the best thing was to do what I like to do. And so in this book, I wrote about something that I was very interested in and figured that the rest would be a combination of how good the book is and how lucky I am.
Science Weekly from Guardian.co.uk.
Leonard Mlodinow there. That's the fourth time I've had to pronounce that name. I think I've said it differently every time. Anyway, his new book, The Drunkard's Walk, How Randomness Rules Our Lives, is out now. More from our main interview with Dan Nocera in a moment. But before we get to that, some comments from the blogs. Ben Duval asks,
can I please ask, why has no one built a space elevator? Anchored to a satellite in orbit just on the edge of space, it'd surely be the most efficient way up into the galaxy beyond. Also, forgive my ignorance, but wouldn't the vacuum of space suck anything up through a tube like a straw? Couldn't we then drain off some of the rising sea levels this way?
Ian, would that work?
Well, first of all, we know, like, obviously Arthur C. Clarke was a big fan of space elevators, and he thought that might work if you could get sort of a completely fault-free sort of string of nanotubes going up to space, because the tension in this thing would be enormous. But anyway, as for the giant straw for reducing sea levels, no, it wouldn't work. I mean, you've got, you know, the water's held down obviously by gravity and air pressure of the atmosphere. I think just putting a straw in, and even if you evacuated all the air out of that and had it going all the way up to space, you're not going to suddenly lose all the water from, you know, the top of the sea up there. I mean, the energy in taking that water up would be enormous.
I'm amazed you're... brilliance in this. Just the facts you know. I think if we counted the number of facts you said in this podcast just until now, it would be more than like Wikipedia or something.
Oh, it's a shame though. I love space elevators. There was an amazing account of one being severed. It's a single carbon filament going up, nanofilament going up in Alistair Reynolds, I think. What happened? It basically spins down and bisects the planet. Very violently.
That's
in the same
incredible.
Way in Red Mars, actually, it happens quite a lot. Space elevators are always getting cut.
Yeah.
They're just, it's a liability, well, frankly. Terrorism and space
gotta be a
elevators.
Terrorist target.
Well,
exactly.
Let's be honest, you can't have a novel without some tension. Okay, well, back to our main interview again, indeed, back to the future. We've already heard how Dan Nocera thinks chemistry is going to solve the energy crisis, but just how will his theory be applied in practice? Producer Ben, roll the tape.
I think we can do this in 20 years or less. The beautiful thing about solar is it's a distributed energy source. So there may not be need for the way we do energy generation now, which is we do it in one spot and then we have to distribute it through power lines. So if this world works the way I envision it, the person in a little village in India will be generating energy at his and her home in that little village, just like some big company in the Western world will be generating energy.
Using a little solar cell of their own.
Solar cell, and then that solar cell will be generating a fuel or powering a battery during the day. They'll be bleeding a little bit of that energy off to use directly, electricity and whatever they need during the day. And then they'll be pushing another piece of it towards storage. They'll be generating hydrogen and oxygen, or they'll be storing it in a battery. And then when the sun goes down, they'll just flip a switch, and that will come on board. And you can imagine, I mean, I can imagine without being too futuristic, that you start building your home so that you have a home, and you during the day, the tiles on the top of the roof and the sides are photovoltaics. It's generating your electricity, all your appliances, all the sockets. You don't need a power line to a station. It just has to get to the roof and the side of the house. And then you're in the basement of your house, you're generating either fuels or you're charging a battery. And then the night comes, you flip the switch, you turn on the battery, or you start recombining the fuels, you get the energy out, and you car, when you drive into the garage, you just plug it right back in and you start recharging your battery for your car. And then in the morning, you open the garage, you leave. So this isn't very hard. I mean, if we have the sun and we harness it, we could very quickly build self-contained living structures that are totally powered by the sun.
Imagine all of that working in Florida, but North England, in Manchester, for example, where there's very little sun most of the year. What would happen there? How much sun do you need?
So that's why – so now you're hitting on a really important point, which has escaped the public's attention. Because you always hear PV, PV, PV. PV, PV, PV generates electricity, and it only generates it when the sun is out. So that's why you need the storage part. So if you're up in Manchester, you might not be generating as much electricity during the day because of the clouds, but we could then ship a fuel to the people in Manchester from more sunny parts. And so that's why you need the fuel storage, so that when the sun isn't out or in the cloudy areas versus the Arizona deserts or the Middle East deserts, that energy would be available to people. That's the key to needing storage. So once you get to these large global energy systems, it's impossible just to do direct energy, which is PV. You need the storage part.
Would you imagine deserts like the Sahara or Arizona being sort of harvesting fields for solar energy?
Yep.
It could be distributed everywhere.
Yep. That I do imagine that. That then gets back to a kind of centralized power generation. So I think that will supplement the world I see. So at your house, you generate whatever you can with whatever sun you have. And then you might have to have more centrally located spots where you're generating because there's a lot more sun there and you collect it and you generate a fuel or you store it in a battery and then ship it to people. So I imagine that sort of mixture, but it would all start at your home first or where you're living first, and then we would use these other places to supplement our energy needs.
Everything we've talked about is a kind of a technological fix to climate change. There's a little danger in that because if people think that technology is going to get them out of this, then we'll carry on using lots of energy.
That's right.
And so on. But is technology going to save us from climate change?
I've done global energy calculations, and I'm just going to give you numbers, and you don't need to fully understand where they come from. But right now, the world uses around 14 terawatts. A terawatt is a trillion watts. So in the world, we're using around 14 terawatts. In the year 2050, we're going to be using 28 terawatts to 30 terawatts, double the amount of energy we use now. That calculation is predicated on unprecedented conservation. At least 90% of the energy we use now, we're going to have to conserve just to get to a doubling. So the technology I'm talking about is to take care of a doubling with unprecedented conservation on your part. And we're going to barely do it. So there is no out here. You're going to have to be the most responsible person in society in the world in terms of your energy use. And then you're going to have to rely on technology to fill it in. If you totally ignore, if you just say technology is going to save us, it's not going to be around 30 terawatts. It could be up around 50 terawatts, 45 to 60 terawatts, which there's no way technology can deliver. So it's going to take all parts of our society coming together and working on this. And that's a great thing. That brings people together. And it's going to have to be everybody. People in China, India, U.S., England, we all have to get in the same boat and start taking care of this problem because it's our Earth that we're going to kill. I want to say we will not kill the Earth. I always tell people, I always worry about the planet. I want to assure you, no matter what we do, the planet is going to be okay. It's going to be the people living on the planet that's going to be in trouble.
It'll kill us.
Yes. The Earth, if we get annoying enough to the Earth, you can think of it like having an immune system. If we get so annoying to the Earth, she'll just kill us like any virus or bacterial infection, and she'll be fine. So we don't want to become that irritating. And with the amount of CO2 we're putting into the atmosphere, we're getting irritating enough to the Earth that she could kill us off. So the Earth's going to be fine, though. I just want to assure everybody. It's the people on it I'm worried about.
Wise words indeed. And if your interest was sufficiently piqued by that, my full half-hour conversation with Professor Nocera is available as this week's Science Extra podcast, which, after your protests, is now back on iTunes. Who says we don't care? So that's it for this week. Head to blogs.guardian.co.uk/science to find links to all the stories we've discussed. My thanks to Ian Sample and Nell Bowes for keeping me company. Science Weekly has been produced by Ben Green, and he's told me to tell you that if you're a fan of The Apprentice, make sure you listen to his other show. It's a media talk special on Sir Alan, Lee, Sophocles, Clure, and the rest of the gang. I'm Alok Jha. See you next time.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.